Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston, and I'm joined today by my colleagues Margaret Harris and Sarah Tesh. Now, if television detective programs are anything to go by, the analysis of blood spatter patterns can play a crucial role in solving violent crimes. But how well do forensic experts really understand the physics of blood splatter? Later on in the podcast, Sarah will be here to analyze the evidence. But first, I'm joined by Margaret to talk about some exciting new schemes for generating electricity from the wind. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish.
So you've been to the Airborne Wind Energy Conference in Scotland, and as far as I could tell, that's all about using kites to generate electricity. Now, that sounds like a slightly bonkers idea to me, but this is a real thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's funny you call it slightly bonkers, because I think I'm on record in Physics World, in physicsworld.com, in a blog post I wrote about a year and a half ago, as saying it sounded like as being as mad as a bunch of as a box of frogs. So I went to a talk, I said about a year and a half ago, that sort of introduced me to the idea that you could use kites to generate electricity via this thing called airborne wind energy. And I thought it sounded mad, but I also thought it sounded really cool. So when there was a whole conference devoted to airborne wind energy in Glasgow a couple weeks ago, I thought, well, I'll go along and see what it's actually about. And so, so I spoke to someone called Rolf Luxinger, who is a physicist and the CEO and founder of a company called TwingTech, which is, again, a company that's based on using kites to generate electricity.
And that was a really great interview, and he does explain it very well.
I think I'll let him explain it. He does better than I can. So
yeah,
here we go.
Here's Rolf.
Okay, so the basic idea of airborne wind energy is to use a flying device on a tether driven by the wind to produce electricity from wind.
How does that actually work?
Yeah, basically you fly your, let's say, kite, or in our case it's more a drone than a kite, in the wind and in a crosswind flight, so it flies a circle pattern and pulls hard on the tether. This tether is on a drum and reeled out, so this drum starts to spin and the attached generator at the ground produces then electrical power.
So eventually the tether must run out. So what happens
yeah,
then?
So that's correct. So in the end, what it does actually, we go out with high force and then fly back with minimal force. So it's kind of a cyclic power production. Read out with high force, retraction with low force.
So that must produce sort of a sawtooth pattern of energy generated over time.
Exactly, so it's not a, like over time, smooth power production. It's basically we have this production phase and the retraction phase where we actually invest a little bit of energy.
So what are the, describe maybe kind of the forces you have to consider as you're designing this sort of system.
Yeah, okay, so obviously what you would like to have is a high force on the tether. So because basically the power you produce is given by the tether force times the reel out speed. So power is force times speed. Mm-hmm. So you want to have high speed and high force. And the force is basically given by the speed of this wing or kite. And so the faster it goes, the higher the force. And the reel out speed is something you control. It's kind of an optimum, because if you reel out as fast as the wind blows, then actually you will not have any tension again. And if you don't reel out at all, then power is zero, because velocity is zero. So there you can somehow find the optimum.
And so presumably you also have to balance things like the force on the tether itself, because the bigger the tether, okay, it will withstand stronger forces, but it would also be very heavy and make it hard for you.
Yeah, actually, it's at least in our case, it's not the weight of the tether, which somehow has an impact, but it's more the aerodynamic drag, because we fly, as I said, crosswind, so also this tether is moved through the air, and actually that creates aerodynamic drag, and this drag can be easily higher than the drag of the wing, and somehow slows down the whole speed and the the end reduces the force.
So how much sort of power are we talking about generating with current systems, you know, the state of the art systems across the industry?
Yeah, that really depends on the system. So there are different technologies out. So the numbers are from a few kilowatts to 600 kilowatts. That's a bit the range.
And that compares to a conventional wind turbine, how?
Yeah, so let's say the bigger wind turbines are 2-3 megawatts. Not the biggest one, but those which you typically see. So we're still smaller, but we're getting there.
Now you've talked a little bit about different types of devices. So there are kite-based devices or soft devices, and your company, TwingTech, has a fixed wing, solid, more like a drone. What are the advantages and disadvantages of those two types?
Yeah, so we also started with soft kites, like almost everyone in the field. In our case, almost 10 years ago, and realized that they're just not really efficient. So it's basically what you would like to have is really fly fast crosswind. And for this, you need this so-called aerodynamic efficiency. It's kind of the ratio from lift to drag, which has to be high. And these soft kites, they're really limited in this way. While basically the ideal lift to drag ratio you have in a sailplane, those have really super high lift to drag ratio. So that really increases a lot your aerodynamic efficiency, and that allows us to produce high forces with a small wing. That's one thing. And the other thing is also we have this retraction phase. And basically these soft kites, you actually have to pull back. So they're stabilized by the pressure of the air. And that means you actually have to invest a lot of energy, and it takes a long time to somehow bring it back. So you lose a lot of energy by reeling it back. While our wing or rigid wing basically can fly back by itself, so that goes super fast and basically without external help. So it just flies back, and obviously we need a bit of tether tension so that it doesn't really touch the ground, but it's really the minimum.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about how these things are controlled at the moment, both at the moment and what the future idea is.
Yeah, obviously that in our case, we have automated this whole flight pattern. I mean, it's clear that has to be fully automated. Otherwise, you will not produce 24/7 power. And we have automated this power production mode. But we still have a pilot on the field, so who could intervene if needed. And basically the next step is that to bring out the pilot of the game. But the algorithms are there and they're proven and they work.
Talk to me a little bit about the safety and regulations of this, because I can imagine, you know, there's already been issues with non-tethered drones causing safety issues for aircraft. And
Yeah, obviously we need permission to fly. And actually, I mean, we're Swiss-based, so we have permission from the Federal Office of Civil Aviation to fly up to 300 meters. So, and actually these permissions are given under drone regulations. And the important thing is it turned out to be quite easy to get these permissions for us for basically two reasons. One is we're actually bound by the tether, so it's kind of clear where we operate. It's not that this thing just flies wherever it could. And the other reason is we fly in a remote area, so it's not like we're flying over a city where if this thing crashes would most likely land on some people's head. So actually the good thing is that these new regulations, drone-based regulations, are really risk-based. So it comes down to what is your risk that basically you could collide in the air with another flying object. And there we are not flying really high, so we're still close to the ground. So that mitigates that risk quite a lot. And the other risk is the so-called ground risk. So what happens if this thing would somehow hit the ground? And there the main mitigation is that we really fly in rural areas where there's no one around. And balancing this risk in a good way allows us to get this permission.
Okay. So some of the future applications that have been talked about today include sort of like tethered offshore. There you would not have the problem of colliding with anything, and it's much reduced. What are some, I guess that's kind of where the industry is going, but there's some intermediate steps along the way. What are some of the intermediate, nearer term commercial applications, I guess?
Yeah, we really focus on this so-called off-grid market as our initial target market. So basically these are remote places which don't have grid power. So today they produce their electricity with diesel generators at high costs and also high environmental impact. And actually our main value proposition for this market is really the mobility, because our systems compared to wind turbine are really mobile. So we fit our product into standard shipping container and can just deploy it there. So that's where we see a very interesting target market to get started with smaller systems, but as the system will grow and get bigger and also electricity costs will come down, then eventually we'll go first onshore, on-grid, and then eventually also offshore.
Okay. How did you get interested in this field? I think you're a physicist by background. How did you get into airborne wind energy at all?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story, but to make it short, actually I was developing new lightweight structures, and basically first for civil engineering applications. And at some point we started to build also wings, because weight is an important issue, and wings and kites. And somehow that brought us into this topic, because we really could build super light kites eventually, and we looked around now what can we do with these kites, and there was obviously producing electricity with kites seems to be a very interesting idea, and that got us into this airborne wind energy topic.
And what's his final question, I think? What do you see as being the sort of biggest challenges, both for Twings Tech specifically over the next short term and with the industry itself for the looking more long term?
Yeah, one of the main challenges is to really find the capital. So finding investors now, because we went through quite some years of research and development where we could somehow live from grants and some private money, but now we really want to build this first commercial product, and that's cost some real money, and that turns out not easy to find this stage. So definitely we, but also all our competitors, are desperately looking for strategic partners who help to invest in this space and really build the first commercial product.
What does real money look like, ballpark idea?
Yeah, some millions, at least to build the first demonstrators on the product scale, and then some more millions to really have the commercial rollout, definitely. So that's I would say, short term, what really is critical, that we have the first product out and we have somehow customers there which are happy with the product and enjoy it, and we can put operational hours on the system and really build up a track record on operational hours. And long term, I think if we get to that step, I'm very optimistic that then the scale up will follow, and we will do the right things. Once really people see that this is a commercially viable technology, and for sure that the next step will follow. And it's clear we need to do something to speed up this transition to sustainable energy, and airborne wind is something where the technology is here, the materials are here, the solutions are here. It's not just basically we need to do it, and we really need to prove that it's a commercial viable technology. That's just the missing piece now, and if the money comes, we will do that in the next few years.
I guess in terms of technological challenges, what would you say was the biggest technological hurdle that is now overcome or beginning to be overcome?
Yeah, I would say it was really launch and landing, as for all flying objects. I think it's once you're airborne, kind of easy, but it's the launch and especially the land is the critical part. And we solved that by introducing drone technology into our wing. So I really have a VTOL, so vertical takeoff and landing concept. So we have three rotors integrated in our wing, which allow us to basically have a control and automated launch and land process independent of the wind conditions.
Okay, yeah, wind conditions was something I was going to ask about, because obviously, you know, presumably you can't launch this sort of thing in a force 9 gale or something like that.
Actually, we can. So, well, I mean, still we need to do more tests, but we already have shown it works in a lot of wind conditions. And I think that's really crucial for us, that we have basically this control ability on the wing with this rotor. So we really can make it stable with wind or without wind. And other concepts which are more like kite based, they always depend on the wind. So if the wind is good in the right range, then it works. But if it's too strong or too weak, then they have some issues there. And I think that was my view for us. The biggest step is really moving away from a kite, which is somehow controlled by the wind, to a drone, which is controlled by the operator. So that switch, which we did like 4 or 5 years ago, that was really the game changer.
So what's your overall impression of this, Margaret? Do you think this idea is going to fly?
That's a really interesting question. And I've actually written a whole feature article about airborne wind energy that's going to be published in the December issue of Physics World, and it will appear on physicsworld.com at some point during that month. So this is a little bit of a sneak peek preview of that. But I think the idea has definite potential in the short term as a means of generating electricity, as Luxinger said, at places that don't currently have access to on-grid electricity, which, by the way, this week includes a lot of people in Northern California because of wildfires, meaning that they had to shut down huge swathes of the normal electrical grid. I can imagine some people there might be saying, gee, a kite that generates electricity, sign me up.
Yeah, especially with those Santa Ana winds.
You might lose your kite.
Well,
they say they can fly it in a really strong wind. The only thing they can't fly it in is no wind. That's definitely not really an option for them. And I think that kind of points to one of the challenges. I mean, conventional wind energy is famously intermittent. The wind doesn't blow all the time, not even during the Santa Ana season in California. But the extra problem is that, so a conventional wind turbine, if the wind is not blowing, it just sort of stops. But one of these kites, if the wind is not blowing, it has to come in and land eventually. Some of them can generate a little bit of electricity on board. They have onboard batteries, so they can keep going for, you know, a few minutes or maybe even hours. I'm not sure exactly if the wind isn't blowing. But they do eventually have to land. And when you have a device that has to repeatedly launch itself in the air and land, I mean, you know, conventional airplanes, that is the most dangerous statistically time of for flying is launch and landing. And so you've got this device that has to repeatedly launch and land, and that just increases the possibility of there being some sort of catastrophic accident, as in loss of the kite, not catastrophic as like a plane crash, I should say.
Yeah, interesting. Rolf made the point that that these kites could be used in remote communities. And I think that, you know, I heard that and I think, yeah, that's interesting. Because I know, you know, for example, in northern Canada, there's a lot of remote communities that rely on diesel generators for electricity. And, you know, these generators tend to be noisy. They tend to be very inefficient and polluting. And then, of course, you've got to schlep all that diesel out into the middle of nowhere. On a regular basis. And I could see the kites being very useful in that situation. But as you say, if these kites are constantly going up and coming down, and, you know, with a diesel generator, you just push the on button. Whereas with the kites, is there going to have to be a kite expert there sorting things out?
Not necessarily. So, I mean, the companies are all trying to move towards more automatic and eventually autonomous operation. But another company I spoke to that I interviewed for this this feature article I mentioned that's coming out in Physics World in December, they have had, this company is called Kite Power, and they've worked with the Dutch military. They're based in the Netherlands. And they were able to teach a bunch of Dutch squaddies, basically, to launch and land their kite and even set up everything very, very quickly, such that the soldiers actually did it much quicker than the team did itself. So I think this is... The flying is automated, so you don't have to sort of sit there and can control the kite yourself. It's just really sort of monitoring the launch and landing. And, okay, yeah, a diesel generator starts with a press of a button, but it's not that hard to launch a kite and land it and this sort of thing. And the important thing is a diesel generator does need regular maintenance. It's not autonomous either. You need to fill it with diesel apart from anything else, and of course there's maintenance involved too.
Well, we'll just have to see. Keep an eye on the sky for electricity-generating kites. Thanks, Margaret.
Thank you.
Next up is Sarah Tesh, who's here to talk about an article in Physics World called The Physics of Blood Spatter, which was written by the physicist and author Sidney Perkowitz. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, this is a really grisly article. What was the inspiration for putting this in Physics World?
Well, Sidney actually pitched it to me because in America, which is where he's based at the moment, it's quite at the forefront of people's minds because there was this big case about Joe Bryan. Do you know this case?
The case where he was convicted based on blood spatter on a hand torch?
Yes.
Yet he was hundreds of miles away when the murder occurred?
Yes. And so there have been various appeals and everything, and it's basically put into the spotlight the fact that this blood pattern analysis might not necessarily be reliable or not. Is it, like, should it be taken as completely 100% infallible and that kind of thing? And so it's big in America because there's obviously there's a fair amount of guns over there. And if it is called into question, this whole area of forensics, then that's quite problematic because it means that people might be... being convicted when they're innocent, or the opposite, like convicted people might be able to appeal, guilty people might be able to appeal their verdict because of this analysis being questionable. So it's quite an important area in forensics.
Yeah, it was a really interesting article because, I suppose you assume, maybe just from watching TV,
yes,
of course, these blood spatter forensic experts, they know what they're doing. This is all hard science.
And, yeah.
We can trust it. But Sidney points out that this blood spatter analysis technique, it lacks scientific rigor, and there's no real sort of valid accreditation process for experts who analyze these patterns. You know, I thought that was really surprising. So what can physicists do to help?
Well, what you're specifically referring to actually is a 2009 report from the U.S. National Academy of Sciences where they analyze all of the forensic techniques there are, and like other than DNA analysis, there's flaws in each of the other techniques, and there's been other reports since then supporting this. And like you said, there's not a prerequisite for getting your blood pattern analysis accreditation in physics. You don't need to have any physics knowledge, but physics actually plays quite a big role because obviously it's blood is a fluid, it's a complex fluid. And the problem of blood spatter is a complex fluid mechanical problem. And specifically, so blood is actually made up of both liquid and solid. So you have to take that into account when modeling it. You also have to take into account all the ambient conditions. Its viscosity and stuff like that is also related to an individual. So that obviously brings about some variations. And then there's the forces around it. So there's the drag, there's the gravity. You have to take all of this into account if you're going to get an accurate model of what created that blood pattern. And at the moment, they don't do that for the most part. So one of the current techniques they use is they look at a blood pattern, and they can work out like the angle it hit the ground by the ellipses.
Well, that's the shape of the spots of blood on the ground.
Exactly. Yeah. So they can work out the impact angle from that. And then at the moment, though, they just draw a straight line along that impact angle to try and find the source.
I thought that was incredible. Yeah.
So obviously, as physicists, you're automatically thinking, well, no, an object wouldn't travel in a straight line from its source. There would be drag, there would be gravity, and it would actually be a parabola. And this is one of the problems, is the fact that this straight line technique means that they are overestimating the height of that the blood originates from, and it could be the difference between the victim sitting or standing. And so that's something they really need to take into account to try and get more of an accurate view of where the blood's coming from, where the victim's position was, because then that's relative to everything else on the crime scene, for example.
You know, I think there's a great diagram in Sydney's article where they show this sort of straight line process, and it looks like a person was floating in the air, meters above the floor.
Yeah, it can be very misrepresented
where they were shot. So, yeah, I mean, that was surprising that anybody would actually bother drawing a straight line when we know that.
You'd think that was very basic level physics, but no, it's not taken into account.
And there's and things get even more grisly because Sydney gets into the whole process of how a bullet sort of travels through somebody and comes out the other side, and you know there's lots of turbulence that's generated, etc., and that affects the blood spatter pattern and can provide important information.
And also there's the whole fact that when a bullet does hit, blood doesn't just fly out in the direction that the bullet is going, it also flies out in the direction it impacted from. And so researchers are looking at all of those issues, the relationship between blood and air and the turbulence, like you said, and the impact forces and things like that. And yes, it's a little grisly, but very interesting.
I mean, but I suppose the good news is that, you know, despite all the challenges of applying fluid dynamics and other sort of physics knowledge, people in the U.S. are actually trying to create transparent procedures for police investigations and criminal trials.
Yeah, so researchers are working with police departments, federal agencies, that kind of thing, to try and actually implement what they've learned in the lab. So they're creating things like cheat sheets of blood patterns where they've created them under a particular set of conditions in the lab, and then those could be used on a crime scene to try and like work out what actually happened. But they're also like creating reports and everything that people can refer to that actually contain some of the physics, so that the actual forensic scientists can have a look at those as well. So they're really trying to like make that link between the lab and an actual practical use.
Oh, it'll be really interesting to see how this, you know, sort of affects prosecutions, and maybe there will be some people who, like this guy we mentioned at the beginning of the piece who's been in jail for a long time now. Mm-hmm. Maybe he'll be found innocent, and maybe other people will be convicted of using these techniques. So thanks, Sarah. And you can read Sydney Perkowitz's article, "The Physics of Blood Spatter," on the Physics World website. And a warning, there is lots of blood in it.
Not all real.
So now Margaret is back to talk about a few of her favorite articles that have gone up on the website this week. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish. Well, it's funny you asked that, because actually my favorite article this week is one that you wrote yourself, which is a news story called "Strontium Detection Confirms Heavy Elements Form in Neutron Star Mergers." So we talked about this before you wrote the article, you know, us in the news team, and I'm guessing that this has something to do with the multi-messenger astronomy observation of a neutron star merger that was made back in 2017.
Yeah, it does. That was a really big deal if you cast your mind back to 2017. It was the Physics World Breakthrough of the Year. And that's because for the first time, astronomers were able to observe gravitational waves and electromagnetic radiation from the merger of two neutron stars. And this resulted in a huge kilonova explosion. And we were able to see light. In fact, I think we can still see light from that explosion today. Yeah.
Okay, so now the thing that interested me is that back in 2017, there was some preliminary evidence that there were heavy elements created in the explosion.
Yeah, astronomers detected light that they thought was generated by the radioactive decay of heavy elements produced in the explosion. Now, these are elements that are heavier than iron, and this observation was important because we currently can't account for the production of about half of all the heavy elements in the universe, particularly the really heavy ones like gold and uranium. Now, we think that one half are produced in stars towards the end of their lifetimes. But since 2017, astrophysicists have been very excited about neutron star mergers and the prospect that these events could create at least some of these missing heavy elements.
Now, the heavy elements part of this is important because we know that elements up to and including, I think, iron in the periodic table are all created by, you know, sort of normal stars doing normal, sort of burning, not literally burning, but, you know, normal nuclear reactions.
Mm.
So, but now we think that there's these heavy elements. That's been a bit of a mystery. So what's new in this work?
Well, a team led by Derek Watson at the Niels Bohr Institute in Denmark, they've taken a very close look at infrared light from this kilonova. And they found spectroscopic evidence for strontium. Now, strontium is sort of a heavy-ish element. It's heavier than iron. And astrophysicists believe that it should be formed via a process called rapid neutron capture. And this is a nucleosynthesis process that requires a huge flux of neutrons. And of course, a huge flux of neutrons would have been created when two neutron stars smashed together. So it seems that Watson and colleagues now have smoking gun evidence that heavy elements were created in this R process when these neutron stars merged.
And so I guess this is actually also some really direct evidence that, and this is going to sound funny, but that neutron stars are in fact made of neutrons. I mean, that seems like an obvious thing and the name's on the tin, right? But it is, that wasn't necessarily well known.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it? I mean, neutron stars were first postulated almost exactly 85 years ago. I think it'll be 85 years in December. And this was shortly after the neutron itself was discovered. And of course, neutron stars, I mean, I'm in my 50s, but I can remember, you know, looking at models of stellar evolution when I was in my teens, and there was the neutron star. So, you know, we've been talking about neutron stars for a very long time. We believe that pulsars, for example, are rapidly rotating neutron stars. But we've always just speculated that they were made of neutrons. But this is actually the first spectroscopic evidence that we have that these incredibly dense objects that we call neutron stars are made mostly of neutrons and not some other substance. So yeah, very interesting.
This is actually kind of parallel to one of the other discoveries that came out of the study, of LIGO's data on merging big objects in the far, far distant universe, because the initial discovery that LIGO made of merging black holes was actually some of the most direct evidence we have that black holes exist.
That's right, yeah. I mean, it is incredible that, you know, we sort of talk about these things as if they, you know, as if they're real things. And I suppose there's lots of evidence, both, you know, sort of theoretical, computational, et cetera, for black holes and for neutron stars. But then, you know, suddenly you get this measurement that really makes it real. And yeah, definitely LIGO was one of those measurements for black holes. And, you know, subsequent discoveries or observations of black hole mergers have told us lots about black holes that we didn't know before. You know, for example, that they have certain masses, et cetera, that maybe astrophysicists didn't think they would have had in the past. So yeah, LIGO is definitely, I suppose, the I don't know, the astronomical instruments or instruments of the 21st century. You know, we're getting tons and tons of information from those gravitational wave detectors, which is fantastic.
I suppose it's like putting together evidence from a lot of different sources in a crime scene, in fact. You know.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
You take the witness statements, it was a black hole that done it, and then you take the measurements, the forensic scientists, and you measure the light, and then you get evidence from all sorts of areas.
Yeah, and it does sound like maybe the physics of a kilonova is maybe a bit less complicated than the physics of blood splatter. But yeah, that's right, it is. Yeah, exactly. It's a bit of evidence, a bit more evidence, yeah. And hopefully much more evidence to come now that that LIGO and Virgo as well, that's another gravitational wave detector, have been upgraded. Yeah.
Okay. So great. So we'll switch gears here. I think we also have something on the website about the physics of alcoholic beverages.
Yeah, this is a really interesting paper that appeared in a journal called, I think it's Physical Review Fluids. This is research that was done, oddly enough, at the University of Louisville in Kentucky.
That famous bourbon-generating area.
That's right. And Stuart Williams and colleagues looked at what happened to samples of whiskey when they were allowed to evaporate. And they discovered that bourbon whiskey, which is made in the Appalachian region of the U.S., mostly in Kentucky, but I think also perhaps in Tennessee, I could be wrong about that.
Alert readers
experts could write in. But they found that when bourbon whiskey evaporated, it left a sort of a beautiful spider web pattern of residue in a Petri dish. And this was very different to other types of spirits, including other types of whiskies, which didn't leave these lovely patterns. And the researchers reckon that the reason is that unlike other beverages, bourbon is aged in barrels that have been charred on the inside.
Mm, that's the difference, okay.
And so that chemicals that have sort of leached out from the charring process, which I'm sure are important in the taste of bourbon as well, lead to this this telltale pattern of spider webs. And, this could be very important because, of course, in the production of spirits, especially high-end spirits, counterfeiting is a big problem.
Yeah.
So this could allow people, a new way of determining whether a whiskey really is a bourbon or if it's just, you know, sort of a cheap knockoff counterfeit.
Yeah, because, yeah. I mean, you could possibly tell by drinking it, but then it would be sort of done.
That's right, yeah, I suppose. Well, maybe that's a better way of doing it.
Maybe so. But there's also something in the same story about the tears of wine, which are these little droplets that supposedly signify a good wine. I think they form around the edge of the glass. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
This is a paper written by Andrea Bertozzi of the University of California, Los Angeles. She and her colleagues take a fresh look at these tears or legs of wine. And these are the little sort of structures that you see if you swirl a very good wine around in a glass, and they sort of appear on the edge of the glass. And I have to say, I didn't look at this in detail. I just mentioned it in passing in the blog that I wrote. She's looked at how something called an under-compressive shock is involved in the production of these tears. Yeah, so we've definitely got an alcohol theme on the blog this week. And that article that I wrote, which has links to both of those papers, is called Whiskey Webs Identify American Spirits and Under Compressive Shocks Give Wine Its Tears. I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Sarah Tesh and Margaret Harris for their contributions. And a special thank you to our producer, Callum Jelf. And remember, if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. And we're also available now on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week. Bye.
Physics World.